The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. It's one of my real pleasures in doing this that Angelo Giardino makes time to talk to me every time there's a fifth week in the month. I consider that both a pleasure and a privilege, and I look forward to months that have 5 weeks. So that's a good thing. Welcome back, Angelo.
Thanks, Paul. And I really look forward to these opportunities as well. I have a lot of fun talking about great books with you.
Yeah, it really does two things. For one thing, I really do enjoy talking to you. And the other thing is, I think I've read books that I might not have read otherwise at your suggestion along the way. And I think this is one that I don't know that I would. I think that the theme is one that I think is extremely meaningful for me, but I don't know that I would have picked up this book. And I think it's very challenging and very rewarding read.
Good. I'm glad you liked it.
Okay. So the book this month is Compassionomics, written by Stephen Treziak and Anthony Mazzarelli. Apparently, Dr. Treziak gave a grand rounds at Primary Children's. Is that right?
Yes. So Dr. Treziak actually has a connection to us here. The chief financial officer at Primary Children's and Dr. Treziak went to junior high together. So they have this connection, and lo and behold, he got involved in this concept of compassion and compassionomics. So Sid Norton, who's our CFO, brought Dr. Treziak in to talk to our board a couple years ago, and it was such a fascinating talk that we decided to invite him to be a visiting professor for a couple days, and he came out and gave grand rounds and met with a number of us and the trainees and some of the faculty.
Oh, that's terrific. So the subtitle of this book, Compassionomics, The Revolutionary Scientific Evidence That Caring Makes a Difference. That sounds like it could be a platitude.
Yeah.
Because I think we frequently say that, but Dr. Treziak's thesis here is that there is evidence that it makes a difference, not just in the kind of care we provide, but in the effects on our ability to do the care that we provide, and that it's not just financially neutral, but it's actually an advantage in every way.
Yeah, you know, he has a kind of an interesting journey to get to that concept. So he is a physician scientist at Rowan University and Cooper Medical Center in Camden, New Jersey. And he does, you know, ICU kind of research and NIH funded, et cetera. But he was challenged by one of his physician leaders to see if was there any science that backed up that essentially being more caring, being more focused on the patient experience, wanting to be more available to patients, is there any science that helps? So he tried to use his physician scientist, you know, literature searching and evidence-based principles, and did a really good job, I think, at finding a lot of literature that kind of triangulates into that. I don't think you can kind of do a literature search and say, does compassion make healthcare better? That's too simplistic. He had to use a more sophisticated or advanced search. So he does a good job at stringing together all these articles that support that demonstrating compassion to one's colleagues, to one's patients, and actually to oneself, there actually is some science that is actually helpful.
Yep. So this term compassionomics is his term. I'm reading from a slide, his from a talk that I watched, the scientific study of the effects of compassionate care on healthcare and healthcare providers. He also tells the story that he started studying this at a time when he felt like he had all the symptoms of burnout.
Yeah.
And that he experienced that as being a very, very dark period in his life, and that this was transformative for him.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because he's a great storyteller. And, you know, if you meet him, he just has this wonderful way of telling the story. But he does relate it to something that's a little pediatric. So if I could share that. So his 12-year-old son came to him one evening and said, I have to write a paper for school. And, you write a lot of papers. So could you help me? And he said, well, what's the paper on? And, this 12-year-old says to him, I have to say, what is the most pressing problem of our time? And he says, wow, that's like quite a topic.
More than I think I did in seventh grade.
Yeah, exactly. So he really then kind of weaves this story about his thinking about what is the most pressing problem of our time, specifically for, an ICU physician who works in a fairly underserved area. And as you said, Paul, who was experiencing some of the manifestations of becoming more and more burned out, more and more depersonalized, disconnected from his work. And for him, he never says what his 12-year-old said was the most pressing problem of our time. But for him, for Dr. Treziak and Dr. Mazzarelli, the most pressing problem was what he calls the compassion crisis, where essentially, this disconnection that could be happening in your professional life from rendering care in a way that you would like to render it, and all the press of the day that you have between the electronic medical record, the need to keep your RVUs up, the increasing level of consumerism. So, you're being asked to do all sorts of things that sometimes people think, is this really what my job is? So I thought it was a really interesting kind of pediatric way to get into this, in that a 12-year-old asked him a question: what is the most pressing problem of our time?
It's interesting. This is a quote from the book. Perhaps it's because a vital ingredient of treating burnout can only be found at the point of care with the patient. And perhaps the real antidote to burnout is leaning in rather than pulling back, which is, I think, exactly counterintuitive to someone who is feeling depersonalized and burned out.
It's interesting because he re refers to some of the work in this book by Tate Schoenfeld and John Noseworthy, who started out at Mayo Clinic and then Dr. Schoenfeld moved over to Stanford. And in their work, they have this idea that there's key drivers in a physician's daily work. And if you optimize those, you push people towards engagement and professional fulfillment. If you suboptimize them or don't pay attention to them or don't get it right, you drive them towards burnout. And this work is very, very consistent with that. So it does sound counterintuitive that if you're feeling depersonalized and you're feeling put upon and you're not seeing joy in your work, to kind of throw yourself into caring more might kind of be the recipe of maybe feeling more sad. But what he lays out, I think, in very compelling writing, and he does pull in some of these articles, is that it's actually reconnecting to what brought us to medicine, that notion of being connected, of helping to alleviate suffering, that actually decreases the depersonalization and gets you more connected. And I think, Paul, if I could, just one other thing that he tries to make the point of is it may not be the energy sink that we think it is. So I'd love to talk a little bit about that energy sink at some point in our discussion.
Why don't we tackle that right now? Because I think one of the things, so the book is laid out in chapters, introducing it then, does compassion matter? Physiologic health benefits of compassion, the psychologic health benefits of compassion, that showing compassion actually helps patients do a better job of taking care of themselves, that it increases healthcare quality and drives revenue and cuts costs. And he makes the argument that, because I think one of the things that we struggle with sometimes is, are people compassionate by nature, or can you learn to be compassionate? And
Right.
he makes the argument that this is a quote from Brené Brown in his book, compassion is a commitment. It's not something we have or we don't have. It's something we choose to practice. So I think he spends most of the book laying the foundation for saying this is not only worth your time, it doesn't take away from anything in patient care. As a matter of fact, it drives much better care across the board at a financial advantage, or I should say, probably an economic advantage as well, and then makes the argument that then we have to embark on this journey to try to do this. Is that fair?
Yes, you really captured that beautifully. And it really starts in the early part of the book. He talks about how long it takes when we ask a patient, why are you coming in today? How long it takes for the physician to interrupt them. And It's really fascinating because there's some research that shows a patient needs about 29 seconds to kind of say what their chief complaint is. It appears from this research that we as physicians interrupt them. The first interruption is at 11 to 17 seconds. So we won't even give them the 29 seconds that they need to just get their quick story out. And then it goes from there.
We actually mentioned that research, talking to some psychologists on the podcast last year. And I think one of the things that becomes clear in that is that if we're following our own preconceptions rather than getting the patient's story, we're actually wasting time.
Exactly. And that's what I think he would say. So, a couple things. One, he makes a really strong argument in the book from some social science work that you're more likely to render help if you have a true sense of how much time you have. But if you feel busy and you feel you have a shortage of time, you're less likely to act in a compassionate way. So, part of the training is to understand some of the true time intervals that it takes to allow a patient to express something, and how much time it takes for a physician to express something that would be experienced as compassionate by the average patient. And then once you kind of know those real time intervals, you may not feel as busy as you think you are. That way, you feel more comfortable engaging with the, you know, those lessons that you learned in the training. So I kind of feel like there's something there. And to your point, Paul, you know, when you think of all the downstream energy sinks that happen, if you don't understand what the patient's talking about, or you don't explain the instructions well enough for them to follow through, think about all the extra time and the rework we have to do when there's a misunderstanding. So he kind of creates almost like an economic theory that if you manage the time well using compassion, you actually ultimately will start to save time and have less adverse events that will truly suck a lot of time out of your day.
And I think it's in that context that he quotes the very, very famous Sir William Osler quote that the patient will tell you what their problem is.
Yeah.
But if we cut them off, we have not had the chance to listen to the patient. I think that's so key to the therapeutic relationship as well as just to the interpersonal relationship.
Yeah. I think he's onto something there. And then, as you said, each chapter tries to take one of those domains, whether it's quality improvement or increased patient safety, the economic benefit from a, you know, from a consumerism perspective, better patient experience, more loyalty from the patients to the health system that you're working with. And then he spends a, I think, a fair amount of time talking about the benefit to the patient, which, you know, frankly, is why we all went into healthcare to begin with, this notion of feeling heard and how that actually improves their health outcomes. So there is something inspiring there.
And I think we can make the argument that a patient is more likely to feel heard if they are being heard. That
Yes.
this is not a play-acting relationship. This is a connection.
It's not faking it. Like, you actually are interested in why they came to see you and how they're making sense of their symptoms. And obviously, if you can kind of get to that, you know, he would argue that there's something really affirming if you feel like you're partnering with your patient. So rather than making you feel burned out or depersonalized, when you actually understand why the person's there and you're essentially helping to relieve their suffering by developing a good treatment plan, that actually is the counter to burnout. And then going back to that Schoenfeld and Noseworthy work, that's actually thinking about those key drivers and optimizing why you went into medicine and why you like to find out what the patient needs you for. That creates professional fulfillment and engagement. And that literature is pretty strong.
I do want to talk about one of the things that he talks about, and that's the issue that compassion doesn't take more time. And so he quotes a study from an oncology group. I can't remember where, but anyway, they talked about a script. They scripted a beginning and ending of each patient encounter that basically tells the patient that I'll be with you through the whole thing. I know this is difficult, and we'll do this together. And then they measured the time that it takes to do this introduction and then sum up at the end. And I think it was 40 seconds of extra time. Want to comment on that?
Yeah, you know, so I think it really is counterintuitive that you could be more available to the patient and somehow that's going to be shorter. I think, you know, in a controlled setting, I have no doubt that you can show that truly adopting these learnings will not add a ton of time to your day. It is going to add some time, but the downstream, I think, is where the savings come in. And I do think they measured, Paul, like, you know, how long it takes to make that compassionate statement. And it was, you know, I think it was less than a minute. It might have been in the 40-second range. So, but, you know, we're not talking about 20 minutes. And I think that's the fear. You know, like, you always have this fear, you know, you're reaching for the door handle. And then you're going to, like, somehow make a compassionate statement that then will now open up 20 minutes of narrative from the patient. That is clearly not the case. And I would say experienced physicians come to terms with the fact you're not going to open up Pandora's box, but honestly, it will add obviously a few minutes. I mean, yeah, I think you have to be honest about that.
And I think the other part of it is, I do think that committing to engage may not save as much time as I think that study suggests. But I think it does mean that the follow-through is more streamlined, because if you actually care about something, I think you're more likely to incorporate it into what you're doing as opposed to making it another task.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And then writ large, I think he's trying to make the point that you can learn some of these techniques so that you can efficiently put them into your day. You know, so it falls a little flat to say, be more caring, you know, but I think if you can learn maybe some scripts so that you can elicit the information you need in a way that the person will experience it as more caring, I think most of us would love to know how to do that.
Absolutely. Right. There are quotes, both well-known and not as well-known, that I think we cite, but internalizing those, for instance, the famous Teddy Roosevelt quote, nobody cares what you know until they know that you care.
Yeah.
That's easy to sort of let slide as a platitude unless you actually internalize that. There were a couple of great quotes from the Dalai Lama in this book. One of them, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion, which I think is incredibly profound. And then also cultivating a close, warm-hearted feeling for others automatically puts the mind at ease. It helps remove whatever fears or insecurities we may have and gives us the strength to cope with any obstacles we encounter. And I think that's huge.
Yeah, I agree. I think the other thing that we can do kind of as a system, I was really happy that Dr. Cheesiak spent some time talking about Schwartz rounds. So we have Schwartz rounds at Primary Children's, and that's a multidisciplinary recurring event where we talk about emotionally laden cases where there might have been some, you know, some issue, whether it's ethical or some dilemma. And we get to talk through the feelings that we've experienced in working that through. And Kenneth Schwartz, who is credited with starting Schwartz Rounds, he talks about compassion as being something that makes the unbearable bearable. And, you know, there's something really affirming about that. And when you think of the hard work that we all have to do in healthcare and some of the, you know, the situations and the sets of circumstances that we have to help families navigate through, there is something really, I think, positive and affirming about this idea of making the unbearable bearable.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it took a little while for me to get traction. Well, that's not true. I mean, it's a very readable book. But I'd have to say that the payoff is a very strong payoff in the last couple of chapters, where I think he makes a very persuasive case for this being more than even just the way to address personal issues with your practice. I think my personal conviction is that my life mission is to develop compassion over the course of my lifetime. And I think that you can make the argument that you can compartmentalize that in your life, and that your life work, aside from your life work, sometimes doesn't get impacted by that. And I think he makes a very persuasive argument that the impact of a life of compassion on what I think is designed as one of the most compassionate of all professions is very profound.
I agree. And what I like about the way he did it is that he really did try to summarize some of the literature. He tries to talk about it the way a physician scientist would. But he does build the case that there really is some good evidence that you improve quality of care, you can do it in a reasonable way, time-wise, that there's an economic argument to make. There's definitely a patient loyalty and experience argument to make. So I think he did us a service. I think I would probably have to agree with him that squeezing compassion out of healthcare in the name of efficiency is one of the most, kind of pressing problems of our time.
And we'll include in the show notes links to a couple of TED Talks. If you want to take 15 minutes to get a feel for what he's talking about here, then there's a TED Talk about that. And there's actually a TED Talk where he talks about his experience talking to his son about addressing the most important issues of our time. The point that he makes that draws together that first TED Talk is we often think that there's an art of medicine and a science of medicine, and they live in different camps. But he sees this as a Venn diagram where there's a very important intersection between the two, that there is science that supports this compassionate approach to medicine. And I think when we carve that out, we miss the point of medicine.
I agree. And I was happy that he cites a lot of literature, some of it that we talked about on this podcast over the years, but he talks about that the book by Dweck on the growth mentality. And I do think you have to have a growth mentality here. You have to be willing to be synthetic and pull a lot of literature together to make the argument for compassion and compassionomics. But if you're willing to kind of see things in a more holistic way, I think you're going to find this pretty compelling.
Absolutely. And again, as I said, I feel like that's sort of my life mission as well. But I think the implications ripple beyond even just patient encounters. I look at the way I treat my colleagues. I look at the way that my job is to try to see other people and really see other people. And I've been very fortunate through the years that I've had partners who have really made it possible for me to see the world in a more personal way. And I'm incredibly grateful for that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Paul. And I can't tell you how strongly I've seen the value of checking in on a colleague. Literally, making the time to just walk by their door, tap, and say, "How are you doing?" I see that happening all the time here at the hospital. And that notion of checking in, it puts a little bit of a bump in people's step after they feel that somebody wanted to see how they're doing, particularly, if there was a tough case or, if something on the personal side's happening. That notion of just coming by and saying, "How are you doing?" Boy, that changes people's day.
Now, let me tell you how fortunate I am. I have a group of partners, and every Tuesday for 25 years, we had lunch and we didn't talk about cases unless that was on somebody's mind. But it was an incredibly valuable experience to know that every Tuesday we had each other's back because we had each other's front.
Yeah, great insight there.
Well, and Angela, let me say that I also feel incredibly fortunate again that we get to talk every time there's a fifth week. I look forward to the fifth weeks. This book, Compassionomics, is available. Actually, I think there's an e-version online. And as I mentioned, the TED Talks are definitely worth your time. TED Talks are kind of a great way to get a quick summary of something. And so we'll put those links in. I really appreciate you recommending this book and really appreciate being able to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Paul. I, again, as you know, I just really appreciate you making the space in the curbside for our book club.
Absolutely. Well, we'll look forward to talking again. I can't remember when we have a fifth week again, but I'll look forward to it.
Great. Thank you.
All right. And thanks everyone for listening. Talk to you again next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.